which of course is devastating for the homeowners.
And the risk is growing as the climate changes. So residents approached the local water authority for help. The agency purchased the old golf course and created a series of stormwater detention ponds. During heavy rain, the ponds collect water that would otherwise run off into streets and homes.
We have the ability to retain 500 million gallons of water.
It's then slowly released into the local bayou. Sharp's group, which is largely volunteer-led, helped restore natural habitat around the ponds so nearby residents can escape to nature and return to a dry home. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Judith Ruiz, Branch Shantia Hudson, Suzanne Potter, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.
I'm Salima Hamrani, and on today's show, it's estimated that one in every 35 children in the United States is adopted. That's somewhere between 2 to 4% of all families. But on today's Making Contact, we're exploring the world of adoption from a perspective we don't often hear, the voices of relinquishing mothers.
Well, when I was 25, I had an unplanned pregnancy. I think it began when I experienced a pretty extreme trauma, being the sole witness to the murder of my significant other in a carjacking.
That's Samantha Gonzalez, a birth mother. And just as a side note, we'll be moving back and forth between birth mothers or women and pregnant people. Most of the research and the interviews for our show were based on people who identify as women, but we also wanted to include other identities. Like many women who choose to relinquish their children, Samantha was facing a lot of challenges: poverty, housing insecurity, and trauma.
And so I was going through an extended murder trial, and I lost my job and dropped out of college, spiraled into a pretty extreme depression, and lost the place that I was staying at. So I ended up sleeping on random people's couches and floors. And that's how I got pregnant. The father had been a friend of my late significant other and sometimes helped me out with a place to crash during the trial.
At the time, she didn't really think she could even get pregnant.
I had been on birth control constantly since I was like 9 and hadn't even thought about menstruating in over a decade. So I wasn't worried about getting pregnant, especially not with the birth control and the condoms. I thought I was safe.
But then one day, Samantha woke up very, very sick.
So I woke up that morning actually having wet the bed and with a really bad backache, and went to work in a whole bunch of pain. And then it got so bad that I had to take public transit home and get a ride to the hospital. In the emergency room at the county hospital, the triage nurse told me that I was in labor and asked me a whole lot of questions that I didn't have answers to, like who my prenatal care was and how far along I was and things like that.
And suddenly, after having gone through a murder trial, Samantha found herself not only pregnant, but in labor.
It was terrifying. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I mean, I thought I was dying, and it turned out I was giving birth, and it was just really extreme and super traumatic being there all alone.
She was in shock and still grieving, and she knew that she was in no way able to parent a child.
The nurses asked me what I planned to do with the baby now that I had no preparation. Did I have a safe place to take it? Did I have a safe place to live at all? It was a hard 36 hours of labor, and I think that was really when I decided to place my son for adoption, was just because I had been going through it alone and I was terrified.
In many aspects, Samantha's experience mirrors countless others. She was navigating a challenging pregnancy with limited resources, but it is unusual in one way. She feels like her adoption story has a good ending. And it turns out that's not how most birth mothers feel about their stories.
Most of the mothers that I interviewed around adoption felt some level of regret.
That's Gretchen Sisson. She wrote a book about adoption from the perspective of birth mothers called Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. And Gretchen wrote the book for two reasons. For one, she had worked with particularly young mothers in grad school.
And that was what really drove my desire to look at adoption, because I was working with these young mothers whose parenthood faced so much marginalization, stigmatization, and who were really framed as irresponsible for the choices that they made. And I wanted to understand the ways that adoption functioned in our broader conversations around young parenthood, right? The idea that these mothers and their children would have been better off if they were not being raised by them.
But she also wrote the book about birth mothers because in our current political climate, after the fall of Roe v. Wade, adoption comes up a lot as an alternative to abortion. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to look at adoption on today's show as well.
And it's not even just coming from the right. President Barack Obama, in his statement on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, would say, you know, that promoting adoption was an important part of the conversation.
And there's one other factor that's important to understand before we dive into Gretchen's book. Adoption is a multi-billion dollar industry. In order to grow and maintain that figure, the industry spends a lot of money targeting pregnant women in order to convince them that, in their view, and compared to abortion, adoption is a morally just, happy way to deal with an unwanted pregnancy.
We're continually told that adoption is a social necessity and a social good, that this is a valid and necessary way of caring for children. And we're told that there is a need for people to adopt, that adopting is an altruistic act.
And that's because, well, there just aren't that many adoptable babies for the extreme domestic demand in the U.S., which is a huge problem for a billion-dollar industry that's entirely based on the availability of babies. Most families want to adopt very young infants, not children or adolescents. There are a lot of kids in foster care, but there are far fewer adoptable infants.
And in fact, when we look at the private adoption system, we have more people who want to adopt than we have infants that are available for adoption. And because private adoption is set up in the context of a marketplace, having a very high demand incentivizes organizations and agencies, attorneys, for-profit brokers that operate in this space to generate supply. And you see that in the way that a lot of these players operate in their targeting of vulnerable pregnant people, primarily poor families, as far as separating them from their children.
So Gretchen set out to understand how birth mothers really felt about their adoption experiences. She interviewed over 100 pregnant people for her book in 2010. Then she re-interviewed a subset of those people again in 2020. What she found ran very counter to the way that adoption is presented in the public imagination. First, her findings shut down the myth that adoption is an alternative to abortion. Most people who want an abortion do not even consider adoption.
I think it's important to understand that when you talk about people who want to access abortion care and mothers who are relinquishing their infants for adoption, you're very much talking about two different groups of women. So people who want to have abortions do not want to be pregnant. They don't want to continue their pregnancy. So there was a survey of several thousand abortion patients. Exactly 0% of them said that they were interested in adoption. 1% said kind of. People who want abortions have little to no interest in adoption. And that is true even if you deny people abortion access. On the other hand, mothers who relinquish their infants felt bonded to their pregnancies early on. They were not interested in having an abortion, even if they had complicated feelings about parenting. But most of them did want a parent and then came to a point in their pregnancy where parenting felt impossible. So this idea that adoption is a meaningful alternative to abortion, or really vice versa, is just not true.
In fact, research has shown that women who get an abortion are generally pretty happy with their decision. On the other hand, Gretchen found that women who relinquish their children for adoption are generally not happy with their experience.
You know, over 95% of people who have abortions do not report regret. On the other hand, most of the mothers that I interviewed around adoption felt some level of regret. For the vast majority of people who have abortions, you have the abortion, and that is a decision at one point in your life, and you move on with your life. For the mothers that relinquish their infants for adoption, many of them, at least at the beginning, were in open adoptions or had some degree of ongoing contact with their child. And so they were constantly negotiating and re-navigating that decision, figuring out how to be in contact with their child, figuring out how to negotiate those relationships with adoptive parents as someone moved or life circumstances changed. And I think that work, that very hard labor of parenting in a different way, obviously, than if they had been raising their child, led to more critical feelings about the adoption over time and left open the opportunity for regret to emerge at any point.
Most of the mothers that Gretchen interviewed had open adoptions, some just exchanging pictures and messages over the course of the child's young life. But some mothers were in extremely open adoptions.
They were seeing their child on a regular basis. They would be on the phone with them directly. Some of the mothers I interviewed babysat for their children, for the adoptive family. One went on family vacations with her daughter's adoptive parents, right? Like, you have that very high degree of openness that's really a kinship relationship that includes both the family of origin and the adoptive family.
Gretchen says that open adoptions like this can help ease some of the darkest traumas of relinquishing a child. Or, in Gretchen's words, it's protective for birth mothers' mental health and well-being.
But openness wasn't fully protective because there was always the chance that an adoptive family could cut off contact entirely in an open adoption, because very few of these open adoptions are legally enforceable.
Usually, a birth mother permanently relinquishes custody of the child with no later recourse. Once the papers are signed, she can't change her mind. And if the adoptive family finds the open adoption too challenging, they can cut off contact at any point.
Openness is meaningful. Openness is important. But openness does not, it's not a panacea for all of the challenges.
For Samantha Gonzalez, the open adoption idea was very important, especially after she went through a traumatic birth. She told me that the nurses had turned pretty cold when she decided to relinquish her baby for adoption.
Well, when I told them that I didn't have a place to stay and I didn't have any money or anything like that, they said, oh, well, you need to get help. And then I said, well, I was considering adoption. And they immediately changed the way that they were speaking to me and started talking to me like I was a criminal. They asked me, was I sure that I wanted to give up my child to a stranger? You know, what kind of a woman would do that? Stuff like that. You know, just really rude questions that were kind of painful and that I had no answers to. In fact, for the 36 hours I was in labor, they didn't bring food or water or even a blanket. They only responded when I was screaming in pain and they could hear me down the hall. But by then it was time for the baby to come.
Soon after the birth, Samantha started figuring out how to proceed with the adoption.
When the social worker came in, they gave me some pamphlets for PACT and a bunch of other adoption agency facilitators, lawyers, and things like that. I was looking through them, and they all looked great. But the one that stood out to me was the facilitator pact, because they spoke about, you know, that the child needed care and racial identity information and birth family information post-placement. And so I didn't know what babies needed, but it seemed like that sounded right. So I chose PACT because it was an open adoption. And I chose the family because they looked like home. They looked like a place that I would want my son to live.
Normally, mothers are discouraged from bonding with their babies if they choose adoption. But in Samantha's case, even after she chose the adoptive parents, the baby needed to be kept in the prenatal ward for supervision.
The first 7 days of his life, I was in the ward with him, holding him, because I didn't want him to be alone, and I wanted him to be bonding with someone. And once the nurses on the ward saw that I was going to be there, they just kind of left him in my care, which further cemented the idea that I wasn't a good idea to be a parent, because I was terrified and had no idea what to do.
And after that, Samantha felt pretty good about handing him to his adoptive parents.
When I handed them off to him, I had already met them at that point. We got together and we discussed, you know, who we were and got to meet and see how we liked each other. And they felt like people I could have been friends with. Their home was warm and inviting. We put each other completely at ease at the very beginning, and then I was comfortable placing him in their arms.
When we come back, we hear more from Samantha Gonzalez and her adoption journey as a birth mother, and we hear from Gretchen Sisson from her book Relinquished about what she learned from interviewing birth mothers. Stay tuned, all that and more after the break.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. Today we're talking about adoption, but from the point of view of birth mothers or pregnant people who relinquish their children. Like Samantha Gonzalez, who found herself unexpectedly pregnant at 25, and who chose her son's adoptive parents based on how much contact they wanted with the birth family.
They said that they wanted an open adoption and that they were open to having a relationship with the birth family. And that was nice and important.
But even though Samantha wanted contact with her son, it turns out that she found it extremely difficult to maintain emotionally.
I had been super depressed before his birth, and then relinquishing him just sunk my self-worth. I didn't feel like I was capable of doing anything because I had basically given up. And it was pretty extreme depression, and I couldn't be around him at the time. At first it was because he was a baby, and, you know, babies are hard to deal with. But then as he got older, I was just avoiding it, and I needed to get help. So that's when I started getting a lot of therapy. It still took me years to be able to visit on a regular basis, and even then, even now, I still struggle with it.
Throughout our conversation, it was apparent that Samantha wanted first and foremost what was best for the child. She knew that her trying to be a mother to him was not the best idea. But she struggles to this day, reconciling her belief that she did what was best for the child with the ingrained social belief she holds about what a woman is supposed to do and feel about motherhood.
We're taught that a woman is going to be a mother no matter what, and that she somehow has like this innate sense of what it means to be a mother or how to do it. And me not coming with those, you know, natural innate sense of this is a baby, I need to take care of it, I need to know exactly how. I was not doing my job as a woman, as a person, as an adult. And that still weighs on me. Even though I know he's taken care of and everything's fine, I still struggle with that. And I've never really been in a successful enough position financially to take care of anyone, let alone a child.
Parenting, especially for women, comes with a lot of social pressure, even after choosing to give up a child for adoption. Gretchen Sisson, who wrote a book about the experience of birth mothers called Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood, said it's not uncommon for birth parents to struggle with this. Samantha knew that she didn't want to parent, and really, over a decade later, she still knows that she would be unable to raise a child. But Gretchen found that for most women who chose adoption, they initially did want to parent.
I mean, a lot of the mothers were in a very vulnerable place towards the end of their pregnancy. That's why they were choosing adoption. That's why they were looking at adoption.
Poverty was a big common theme. And in fact, Gretchen found that if some of these mothers had access to even an extra $1,000, they would have chosen to keep the child.
And what they need that money for is not to raise their child. It's to feel like they have the capacity to make a different decision. It's the amount of money that they feel they need to buy a car seat, buy a crib, feel like they have the basics of what they need to bring the baby home from the hospital. It's the money that they need for a security deposit on a new apartment so that they can move out from their parents who aren't being supportive, or they can leave their boyfriend who they feel like is unsafe to have the baby around. It's these very basic things that would allow them to carve out in their life a space for the baby, to make that feel accessible and tangible.
In fact, some women already had children, but they felt like they couldn't afford another one. Or they went on to have kids after they relinquished their first. And the realization that all they needed was an extra $1,000 or more support in order to parent well, it changed a lot of the birth mothers that Gretchen talked to. Some of them became pro-choice when they had initially been pro-life. Some became more critical of their churches or social support systems.
So these women were not particularly inept mothers, right? They weren't incapable of parenting. They weren't incapable of loving. They needed support. It was a struggle. It was a lot of work. I'm not saying like, oh, this would have been very easy for them. But I am saying that they could do it. And I think that is what radicalized a lot of them. So a mother who would relinquish and then a year later have a baby and say, oh, I could have gotten through that. There was nothing about me that was fundamentally inadequate to parenting, but I could have done this if someone had just given me a little bit of support. But for so many of them, the only friendly face they encountered during their pregnancy was at the adoption agency. That was the only person willing to give any type of support or vision for what was possible. And of course, that was relinquishment.
This was often reflected in a birth mother's view of the adoptive family. Gretchen met a lot of mothers who were struggling financially when they decided to relinquish. And the first time Gretchen interviewed them in 2010, the mothers were head over heels in love with the adoptive families.
When they were choosing an adoptive family for their child, so much of what was lacking in their own lives was what adoptive parents would showcase, you know, in their letters or the materials that they were sharing with the agency. A lot of the mothers were relinquishing because they didn't have a partner that they wanted to co-parent with. Maybe he wasn't showing up. Maybe he was unsafe. And then you look at these adoptive parent profiles and you see these like gorgeous wedding pictures, beautiful descriptions of each other. And a lot of the mothers were relinquishing because they didn't have stable homes, housing situation. And then you would have photos in the profiles of these gorgeous suburban homes and backyards, and talks about walking through their neighborhood and the farmer's market and the safe school. You know, I'm exaggerating a bit, but very honestly, not much, right? That's what these profiles are done to showcase, is this sort of family ideal, to sell this idea of not just the specific adoptive family, but of the idea of adoption in general, what it can give to your child. A lot of the mothers that I interviewed felt very starstruck. Look at this beautiful family. Look at how much they can offer my child. Like, who wouldn't feel inadequate next to these beautiful images and narratives? And I think that so many of them had to believe that they were doing the best thing for their child. And they were in this kind of honeymoon period. And it wasn't until more time passed that they came to a more critical understanding of what happened, both a reckoning with how they were supported or usually not supported. And I always tell the story of Leah, who you know, when I first interviewed her in 2010, talked about how every adoption should look like hers.
And by the way, the names of the mothers Gretchen references from her book have all been anonymized for their privacy.
She loved her son's adoptive family so much. She really felt like this is the best thing she could have done for him, for her, for them. This is going to be beautiful. Every adoption should look like hers. And when I asked her again in 2020, she just said, this adoption never needed to happen. If I had been given just a little bit of support, this adoption didn't need to happen.
Of course, not all birth mothers have bad experiences. Though many people came out of a honeymoon period and changed their minds about the adoptive families, some did remain happy and hopeful that they had made the right decision.
I definitely don't regret it. It was the best decision that I've ever made in my entire life, and that's something that I will maintain.
Samantha, despite her own struggles of self-worth, has a good relationship with the adoptive family of her son.
His family is great. They've always been very welcoming and including me in their family and sometimes in their holidays. That's always awesome. And so we're all really good friends. He's a teenager, so we talk whenever we can, but, you know, it's not a lot because he's a teenager.
Does he know that he's adoptive, that you're his birth mother?
Oh, yeah. He's been impacted his whole life, and they've been talking about me and his story and his birth father and everything like that his whole life. And I mean, if he ever had any questions, he knew that he could always talk to us or ask anything, and we would always tell him the truth. My story is like not really the common story. I have a really good relationship with the adoptive family and with my son. And I mean, our history isn't traumatic. There's a lot of stories out there. I mean, it's like birth mothers are just used as baby factories and then put away.
Which is why Samantha, like Gretchen, believes we need to expand the way we think about raising children and how that could look. She even started working for an organization called Reproductive Justice in Adoption that does just that. If, for instance, you want to get an abortion, you should be able to easily get one. If, however, you decide you want to carry the child to term...
Okay, so your choices are actually not really that limited. You've got like kinship care adoption, you've got foster care, you've got all sorts of ways of keeping this child alive that may not necessarily have to do with adoption, but there's also adoption. So we wanted to make sure that you knew your options. We wanted to make sure that pregnant people knew their rights, and we wanted to make sure that they knew what they could do to stop coercion from happening.
In fact, Samantha's organization, Reproductive Justice in Adoption, partnered with Planned Parenthood to put out a website about non-coercive adoption choices. And you can find that link on our website. But Gretchen says we have to think bigger. First, there are states that are passing laws to try and prevent coercion on the part of the adoption agencies, or that would require a birth mother to have her own attorney for the adoption procedure. But there's also the kind of large-scale social support networks that would provide a safety net for all pregnant people, regardless of what reproductive choices they end up making.
That sort of policy agenda is rooted in things that seemingly have nothing to do with adoption, because they're largely just about supporting vulnerable families. Affordable housing, living wage jobs, accessible childcare, early childhood education, food security, all of those pieces that are going to support millions of other families that are living in poverty, that aren't at risk of separation, are also going to help keep families together. But then the other piece is that we have to question whether permanently separating someone from their child, a full legal separation, is really the best way to care for those children, whether that's in the child's best interest or the parent's best interest. Are there other ways of caring for children that allow them to have a really strong and resilient connection to their family of origin? The idea that children can only have security, connection, and permanency when you have completely legally cut off their relationship to their family and then created another family unit, like that's actually a fairly uncreative way of thinking about what children and families need.
And Gretchen says that while we continue to hear from birth mothers and adoptees it's important to remember that the adoption industry was not the primary way that communities dealt with children whose parents were not in a position to take care of them at the time of their birth.
This idea of a marketplace-based adoption system is historically new. It's only lasted 150, 200 years, like at the longest. This is what is the anomaly. Thinking more deeply and more broadly about other ways of caring for people is how it has been done for most of history.
That was Gretchen Sisson talking about her book Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. You also heard from Samantha Gonzalez throughout the show talking about her experience as a birth mother. And that does it for today's show. If you liked what you heard and want more information, please visit us online at www.focmedia.org. I'm Salima Hamrani, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter